The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets rising too far, too fast. Rate hike bets close to 100%. Bonds sink and the dollar surges. And our guest today, Tian Yang from Variant Perception. All this and much more on episode number 485 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, minus my voice. Thanks for joining me. We're going to have a great show for you today, as long as my voice does hold out. Fortunately, I did have the opportunity to interview my guest yesterday before my voice magically just disappeared. And we do have a lot to talk about some of the very interesting things that went on during this week. Now, one of the things that I saw that was pretty remarkable last week, if you didn't notice this and you didn't see this, you have to take a look at what went on in one particular sector. It was remarkable by any stretch, by any calculation. And that was the move in the shippers. I'll take one stock as an example. A company called Dryships, D-R-Y-S. That's the symbol, D-R-Y-S. These are dry bulk shippers, and the... you know, the idea is that they move various products, particularly for those in the manufacturing area that could be used for building or supplies or whatever it may be. And what was really interesting about this was that we saw stocks in that sector go and move 50, 60, 100, 200% in a day last week. Not just one day, multiple days. Dryships went from somewhere in a low, let's just say from $5 per share. I think it peaked out at $115 per share. Now, why was that? What happened? Well, first of all, these stocks, for the most part, have been coming down for a long time. Stocks aren't worth as much because the companies aren't worth as much. There's been a lot of reverse splits. The share float, or the amount of shares outstanding to trade. So not the total shares outstanding, but the shares outstanding held by investors. So you have that component, and then you have the rest of the shares that are owned by the company, or the treasury shares. But when we look at the shares in float, the numbers that can be traded and in the hands of investors on a daily basis, wow. I mean, we're talking about under a million shares, 750,000 shares in some companies, 500,000 shares in other companies. And when we look at this move that we saw, I was looking at it saying, well, what's the catalyst? First, I thought, well, maybe it's just a reverse split. Maybe these numbers aren't right. Maybe it's just simply that there is a reverse split that went on, and there is this kind of a move that is really not true, but somehow the charts and the data providers didn't provide the right data. When I looked further into this, I found, well, that's not the case at all. In fact, these stocks did move up that much. Why? I think it was simply a short squeeze, and simply because it is so thin to trade these stocks that they moved up remarkably. Now, what I thought was even more interesting was that on the third or fourth day, when Dryships finally moved up to about 115, the stock was halted. It was a regulatory halt where the NASDAQ wanted to see, well, why is this stock moving? Because the company also said that they have no idea why the stock was moving at this level. Well, they came back and there was nothing. Stock opened up at 115, closed the day, that next day at 11, down about 85%. Opened up the next day at about 11, closed probably about, I don't know, 15 or 20% higher, I think it was, by the end of the day. So These are great stocks for trading with one big caveat. And the caveat is that they continually halt throughout the day because of the move. Because there's so little shares out there to be traded, what's happening is that the moves are exacerbated. People are trying to get ahead of it, buying at market, which you should never do with these, by the way. If you ever have a stock with a very tight float and it's moving dramatically, putting in an order to buy at market is perilous. Because what's going to happen is you're going to get a price that you have no idea what it really is. You have no idea that if it's trading at $7 right now, you put a market order, you can get this at 12. Until it actually trades off and it's picked off on the other side, you don't have no idea. So you want to make sure to put in limit orders. I'm not even suggesting you trade these, by the way, because the volatility is enough to give you a heart attack. I mean, really, it is enough to make you nauseous throughout the whole process, and it will make you do very bad things to your portfolio. If you're able to catch it just right for whatever reason, and then you sell it just right, and that works out really well for you, that's great. But the probability is you're going to get caught wrong-sided. Now, once the stock came down to 11, which still is well over the valuation of the company, it looked like there was another short squeeze that started going on. It was up, I think, 50 or 60% on Friday itself. And this is not unique just to dry ships. We saw several different companies, Sino Global Shipping, a couple different Chinese companies. There was probably, I would say, 10 or 15 different stocks in the same sector that for whatever reason, somebody was targeting them or a group of people were targeting these to squeeze the shorts, to move the stocks up, and then to try to bail out as best as possible. Volume was in the 5 or 6 million shares for the day, which was good. As a matter of fact, much higher than the average volume for these stocks. But still, the bottom line was something was definitely wrong. This is not normal. Even the stock going up to $100 from, let's say, $5 was not a... We couldn't say, well, maybe somebody's buying the stock, because who is going to buy the stock with the earnings they have, the assets they have, the debts they have for $100 a share? Maybe if it went from $5 to $10, maybe even 15, I'll give you 15. Maybe if it went to 15, I could say, well, maybe there's some buyers. Maybe there's a consolidation of the industry happening. Maybe something's going on that's very interesting that is going to change things. Who knows? Maybe there is this quote-unquote Trump trade going on with these stocks, and possibly there's a thought that because Donald Trump's, the president-elect, is looking to put in a massive infrastructure spending bill, that a lot of people are saying, well, then the shippers are going to do very well. But if you really think about that, that doesn't make sense either. Because what's happening there is that would be shipping from places outside the U.S. And Donald Trump is looking to do U.S.-based growth, U.S.-based companies, products that are manufactured in the U.S. And why would the shippers do anything? Now you could say, well, maybe because there's going to be a lot of growth there, that a lot of other countries are going to be buying our products. And they're going to want to do infrastructure spending also, follow along exactly what's going on, if in fact it works out well here. But you have to then think, wait a minute, the dollar is at 101. That's making our products much more expensive for the rest of the world. And therefore, who's going to be buying those rather than trying to do it with their own products? So the whole thing made no sense. Let's just get to the bottom line. There was absolutely no sense that I could make of any of the moves with this. And that's why the regulators are looking into this to find out what's going on with this. Is it some kind of a pump and dump scheme? Is it somebody doing some nefarious actions to try to just build the stock up and then it just plummets? I don't know. But I can tell you, when you see this kind of scenario play out, what you do know is that there is a bullish environment that we're in, and somebody's playing games. Take a look at the stock. You'll see what I'm talking about. DRYS. Also look at Sino, S-I-N-O, not to the same degree. Clearly, Dryships was the one that was major, the major player for the week. That was, pretty excessive. Let's see what else we saw last week before we get to our guest, so I can give my voice a little bit of a break here. Like I said, we recorded, fortunately, we recorded the interview with the guest yesterday in this circumstance, and you'll hear my voice a little bit better here. Best Buy came out with earnings, and I thought it was really interesting. When my computer system went down last week, during the evening, I went over to Best Buy to see a couple of different parts I needed, a few things I needed. You know what I did? First of all, I wanted to look around and see what was going on at Best Buy. The stores look a lot better, at least the store I went to, looked a lot better than they have in the past. That was great. The second thing that was interesting was I was able to play and utilize the new Oculus Rift by Facebook, the virtual reality system that I was able to play a game of basketball. That was very cool. If you haven't had the opportunity to utilize this, where you put this device on your face and it covers up your eyes and your ears, you look to your left, you look to your right, you look up, you look down, you look all the way around, and this thing has just great graphics and is extremely responsive. No lag that I saw. And I played a game of basketball, just a free throw game, where you have to kind of reach over and actually reach down, grab a ball, and then throw it. Really, really cool. Really neat overall graphics and all that. They have things like rock climbing, other fantasy games, action games. Very, very cool. Will this be a big pickup? I don't know. For gamers, it's pretty cool. I'm not sure how many gamers are going to actually want to rush in to buy something like this, but it is definitely a technology that will be growing and advancing over time, and I think it will be used. But again, just to check it out, they do have demos over Best Buy for that. But Best Buy did, in fact, blow out earnings. They beat by a wide margin on their EPS. The revenues came in pretty strong. So I guess there is a bit of a move back to going to Best Buy, especially because their prices these days are not so far off of where you can find things online. There was a time that if you went to Best Buy, you knew you're going to pay an upcharge, even though you can get the product right then and there. You wanted a TV, you wanted some kind of stereo device, you wanted a computer, you wanted a laptop. A lot of times you go to Best Buy and check it out, touch it, feel it, see what's going on with it, and then say, let me price comparison shop, and you found it somewhere else cheaper. These days, Best Buy is keeping pace with the pricing of most, not all, but of most of the online retailers, therefore giving you the opportunity to buy the actual device right then and there, not worrying about that you have to pay a major premium because of the availability and for the opportunity to get things right there instead of waiting a day or two. So they really smartened up their game overall. And again, as I mentioned, the store was stocked pretty well. A very impressive stocking of different goods. The layout of this particular store in Fort Lauderdale, I thought was excellent compared to where it was just about a year and a half ago, where really there was not much there. So I was pretty impressed with that. I'm not a real big fan of Best Buy, the stock itself, but this maybe turned me a little bit. I was pretty impressed with that. Now, Walmart also came out with earnings last week. There was some declining profitability overall. And the good news is that they did okay. Their outlook was a little soft. So there's still some question as to whether or not Walmart is going to be able to continue on with any kind of growth. Now, in terms of the earnings season, now we look back at the earnings season, about 95% of the S&P 500 companies have reported their third quarter results. And here's what's interesting. Actually, they showed a growth of 3% on earnings on a year-over-year basis. Now, that's good. Because for the last several quarters, we've been seeing declining results. And the big question was going to be, are we in an earnings recession that's going to continue on for a very long time? And then, lead to things a lot lower because the markets really haven't cared about this too much. They keep on looking out into the future and saying, well, things will get better, don't worry about it. But we did see finally a actual report that is now giving us a little hope that the earnings recession may be over, at least for now. We'll have to see how the dollar index and the strength in the dollar will affect many of the major companies, the large cap in particular. And of course, with all of this going on in the background, with the key reports from inflation and employment, and also now with fiscal policy changing in a way that may be supportive of GDP in the future, the rate bets for a Fed increase in December have increased to like 95%. They were 81% about a week and a half ago. Now they're about 95%. And I think historically, the Fed has not ever looked at a rate that high or a probability rate that high and not raised rates, which is probably why also bonds have been selling off as they have. And also we're seeing that the dollar has been rising so significantly. So in a nutshell, we're seeing a continuation of this Trump trade. We'll see how long this plays out or if there's going to be some question as to actually how, after many of the appointments get put in, how there's going to be all this that gets put into action. But right now, at least for the moment, there's a lot of optimism out there. And our guest today is Tian Yang, and he's the head of research at Variant Perception, a macroeconomic research group catering to hedge funds, banks, and family offices. And basically, Tian works and focuses on using a proprietary leading indicator and a variety of them to generate actionable investment ideas. He's worked for Bank of America Merrill Lynch, where he's jointly responsible for building out the Delta One Global Index business, which is a mouthful, and holds a BA in economics from Cambridge. How are you, my friend?
Yes, I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. I had a lot of things. I've been reading your research. And your research is interesting because what's nice about it is, and I guess that's where the word variant comes in, it's not the same as what we'd see necessarily from every other economic group. And obviously that's your intent, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously ultimately when we talk about variant, we really mean trying to be contrarian, but you know, in a disciplined way. So obviously disciplined investor, I think that's what we're trying to go for. How to build a framework that allows you to be contrarian, but in a disciplined way.
So let's talk about some of the things that you recently wrote about. And you talk about the pitfalls of economic research and analysis as applied to investing. And I think many people know these days that one of the hardest things to do is to understand the correlation or lack thereof of economic data that's coming out these days and actually the investment climate. In other words, it used to be way back when, back in the old days, where you know you saw an economic indicator or an economic stream of information come out, and it was kind of negative and soft. And what happened there was that it wasn't necessarily good for markets. But these days, it's opposite. What's going on with all this?
So I think absolutely. I think ultimately the problem when you first come at macro is that typically data gets released, and some data tend to surprise on the upside, some on the downside, and often it ends up being somewhat of a jumble. So essentially what we're trying to do is, instead of trying to almost outthink and be smarter than every other person, what we're trying to do is figure out if there are structural relationships and if there are structural problems with current research methodologies, that hopefully if we can avoid those structural problems, it will kind of lead us to a much clearer picture. And so in particular, there are kind of three structural problems that we typically try and highlight to our clients and that basically inform our investment framework. So the first is this idea that not all economic data is created equal. So some data tend to systematically lead the business cycle, some tend to be coincident, and some tend to be lagging. So for example, things like building permits, that's a very good leading indicator to watch, because when building permits rise, typically it's followed by construction activity. And obviously in turn, when there's construction activity, then eventually you say it's residential, then people move in. Consumer confidence goes up, they buy white goods. So typically when you see a turn up in building permits, it will actually lead to all these kind of follow-on activities further down the line, which is what makes it a leading indicator. Now, the problem is that in the market, people don't seem to differentiate too much between this idea of leading, coincident, and lagging. So for example, people focus a lot on things like unemployment rate, which actually tends to be quite a lagging indicator. If you think about it, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and you run a business, you're not going to go out and fire someone just at the first sign of trouble. typically you may adjust their hours or, you know, try and like do some other kind of efficiency improvements in the business before you necessarily fire someone.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in that example, say if you looked at hours worked, that would be more of a lead indicator than the unemployment rate.
Right.
So the first thing is this idea of differentiate between leading, coincident, and lagging.
Uh-huh.
The second kind of structural issue is what we would call the vintage data problem. So it's important to bear in mind that all economic data is revised, some very heavily, and often it can be revised up to a year later. So again, we need to understand what are the kinds of data that are going to be minimally revised or not revised at all. So again, you know, particularly bad corporate hit like GDP or like non-farm payrolls, where the first print often is very, very noisy. So that, you know, if you're going to trade around it and you want to take advantage of positioning, that does make sense. But if you're going to actually make investment decisions, thematic investment decisions on the back of it, is probably not the best thing to do.
So when we look at so it sounds like, well, a couple of different things. Number one, you prefer leading indicators, and some of them, obviously. The lagging indicators are just that. But why is it that market participants focus in on some of these in a very significant manner? I mean, obviously, the unemployment rate is one of the ones that we look at on a regular basis that, you know, if you look at any kind of standard economic plot, they say, well, this one is a higher or a low level of importance for markets. But unemployment rate and a few others, even though they are lagging, it's a major focus. And is that a new phenomena because of the Fed and the central banks?
Partly, I think so. That's one of the reasons, because clearly, especially with the U.S. with the dual mandate, they're targeting inflation and unemployment, two of the most lagging indicators out there. And obviously, if people are reacting to the Fed and their response function, then clearly people do need to pay attention. But I think the second thing is trying to understand what's the objective of doing economic research. I think traditionally, economic research has been done to kind of get a wider sense of the overall bigger trends in the economy, right? Where's the trend going? What's kind of the bigger picture? And I think that's probably why previously people used these kind of data points where you only need one data point a year, right? So you just plot something every year and you see over this 15-year period, the economy's done something. Obviously, if you're kind of in the markets and you want to try and narrow down your timing window, then suddenly you can't really rely on those kind of data that's not released very frequently. Instead, suddenly you need to get more of a sense of the cycles within those big trends, the kind of monthly, what's going on in 3-6 months kind of time horizon.
So let's kind of skip over to this area of sell-side research. And I think there is something that you've written about quite a bit on some of the basic and inherent flaws. Now, one of the things that we know is that sell-side research, different than buy-side research, is something that is given to, provided to investors for an enticement to actually go out and say, well, this is a great stock, buy it. And then it creates commissions and it creates transaction fees, et cetera. Whereas buy-side research, you have to actually go out and purchase usually. It's not so readily available. It's not necessarily free to just clients of a brokerage firm. It's something that is from a firm that provides, like your firm, your buy-side research, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what is the inherent problems with sell-side research that people need to be aware of?
So I think firstly, I will say this. I think there's a lot of very smart guys on the sell side. And indeed, when I worked there, I knew a lot of very good analysts. So I think this is not necessarily a smart versus dumb or like whether they get analysis right or not. I think it comes back to ultimately what people are trying to achieve, again, with their research. I mean, what I've tended to find with sell-side economic research is that typically it's too kind of obsessed with predicting kind of where GDP growth is going to be next quarter, right? Whether it's like, you know, 1.5 or 1.6. And there's a bit too much focus on kind of the decimal point rather than trying to look at turning points. So, you know, this is kind of a methodological issue, right? So typically in economic research, people build some kind of regression model. But really, when you think about it, a regression model is basically taking all your various data points that typically move in a cycle and then averaging it. So you're basically turning into a straight line with your model. Now, why do you do that? Well, if your job is to sell on the sell side, you need to predict GDP every quarter, then clearly by doing that, you're going to be correct on the average over the cycle. But the problem is that when you build that model, by definition, when the turning point comes is when your error is greatest, because you haven't calibrated it to be sensitive to the turning point. You've calibrated it to be on average correct on level prediction over the cycle. So I think that's one of the core methodological things that we do at Variant Perception. Essentially, we're very much trying to focus on turning points. And indeed, what we're actually trying to do is correlate turning points in leading economic data with turning points in Cohen's economic data. Hmm. And then basically when we observe the turning point leading data, then we can make a forecast. So it's not even necessary prediction anymore. It's one, you know, I would kind of term it as observing and inferring. We just wait, we observe the turning point, and then we can infer that coincident data will turn. And then at that point, we see if this is priced in the market or not. And if it's not, that creates the kind of really attractive risk-reward opportunity.
But if there still is this situation where we see that there is a underlying bid or an underlying belief that the Fed is going to continue to provide, and if there is a soft patch, for example, let's go over and take a quick journey over to China. And we know that there's a lot of things that were going on in China over the last year or so, and there was the government coming in once again to flush in all sorts of money. And even though it created a lot of problems, and there's a potentially, which I want to ask you about, a bubble in the housing price area where people were just rushing in and going in to buy homes. They were trampling over people, actually, in some circumstances. And the banking, we know the banking industry has a lot of really bad debt on the books, but it doesn't seem to be causing, whereas it was a problem at one time, and even you look at the yuan is dropping, it's at a, whatever, 6-7 year low at this point. That was a big concern for some time. Nobody seems to care about this anymore.
Right. So I think here it's important to differentiate between a structural thesis and a more cyclical kind of leading indicator-based approach. So I 100% agree with you. Obviously, China, there's a massive structural debt deflationary dynamic playing out. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of concern around the banking system. And I would say that's probably pretty well understood by the market in general, in that clearly debt's unsustainable, you know, incremental marginal value of more credit is getting lower and the like. But I think the difference and how to kind of take advantage of it is to focus on leading indicators on kind of a much shorter 3 to 6 month horizon. So basically, at the beginning of this year, our leading indicator for China actually turned up very aggressively, just as there was sort of max peak fear about a Chinese devaluation, the fact China was going to blow up. And basically what was driving that was that real M1 in China basically started rising very aggressively, started turning up. And typically M1 is a very good leading indicator in China because it typically, you know, when that goes up, it shows that there's ready liquidity in the system, and that'll typically go towards supporting asset prices as well as providing a floor on industrial production. And obviously in that situation, you know, it doesn't necessarily say China was suddenly going to go on the new growth miracle, but it was an example where we saw there was a divergence between leading indicators and what was priced in the market. So you had quite good risk reward at that point to try and fade the bearish China move, where clearly I would agree the structural story is there, but when everybody's already on the trade and then suddenly your leading indicator suggests that data is going to start surprising, that's the kind of opportunities we're trying to look for.
That's, of course, if we believe the China data, but that's another entire discussion. You know, because I find it very hard to believe that estimates of, let's say, GDP at 7% or, you know, industrial production or, you know, industrial profits come in. There's all these estimates and miraculously they're right on the estimate almost every time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other big challenge with China is often we'll find leading indicators that are very good that work, and then suddenly the authorities just stop publishing it. So like a very good leading indicator previously was they had a PMI survey for basically supply delivery times. So again, this is a leading indicator that makes intuitive economic sense, where essentially if your suppliers start taking a lot longer to deliver things to you, it suggests they've reached somewhat maximum capacity. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they're obviously running lots of excess capacity, they can react quite quickly. So, you know, that you can still apply the basic kind of economic intuition to look for these kind of relationship and see if they do actually play out in the data. But yeah, I agree that the main challenge is they keep basically discontinuing data that works. That's the big challenge.
Now, why again, you do a lot of writing, and in a recent article that you looked at in the end of October, you looked at investors and record levels of cash, and then you came back and you talked about on the same day, the households are very interested in stocks, general, you know, retail investors, et cetera. Meanwhile, we have this divergence in the data, right? So we have on one hand, we have record levels of cash in for investors. And on the other one, oh, well, we're very interested in stocks. What was that telling you?
So I think actually what we found was that households actually running record lows on cash. I think there were some fund manager surveys that suggested people were holding some cash on the sidelines. So again, I would think we need to differentiate between structural and a cyclical time frame. So it's important to track things like how much household assets are invested in financial assets and in equity market, because these tend to be more longer term structural positioning indicators that tell us overall, are we early or later in the cycle? Whereas the more fund manager stuff, I would argue, is probably somewhat more shorter term in terms of people reacting to trade. So I think that that's the differential. Ultimately, the bigger picture is obviously that positioning wise, speculators might keep flip-flopping in terms of the views on the US market, but overall households are quite invested right now. Obviously, that that might be partly to do with the move towards passive, obviously because things have been going well, everyone's kind of held on to it. It could be central banks forcing everyone to search for yield and moving to equities. So I think it's more overall structurally, we know that positioning is somewhat late cycle, so it doesn't really make sense to be super bullish right now, given, as you say, fundamental economic data has actually been deteriorating somewhat. So I think the key is time horizons again.
Now, just to kind of close up on something here, I think one of the most fascinating things, and I'm going to guess in advance that you would agree with me, is that we had two major issues that were called completely wrong by not only markets, but by pollsters, et cetera. First, we had the Brexit. Now, the Brexit came in and it was a surprise. And, looking back on it, we, I think, realize now that there is an incredible people are crying out for change and they don't like what's gone on, even though asset prices have done very well over time. And generally speaking, that the wealth effect is moving and economies are kind of slogging along, but okay. The fact is that I think a lot of people realize that there's a tremendous amount of, covering put over the melting ice cream, But at the same time, we saw that post-Brexit, which was supposed to be a very significant marker for the equity markets and currencies, and of course, we saw that the cable or the British pound dropped significantly, and they're still talking about it in the government about potentially putting some further pressure on it to help to offset any of the Brexit issues. And now we're starting to hear some other garbage about, well, the Supreme Court in the UK says maybe we don't have to do this for at least 2 years, and a lot of shenanigans going on there. But we saw that markets dropped down for about 2 or 3 days, 4 days, something like that, and then ramped higher. That's example one. The second one was with the election of Donald Trump for US president here in the US. And even some of the bookmakers, the odds makers, Paddy Power, paid out a month early on the election to those that bet on Hillary Clinton. And it was a foregone conclusion for the most part that Clinton was going to win. And the other underlying understanding was that if, in fact, Donald Trump won, markets were going to have a very difficult time. That was the setup, right?
Right.
And post-Brexit, we saw this incredible ramp in markets. And post-Donald Trump, we saw this incredible ramp in markets. Is this just algorithms trying to screw with people? Or is there something else that everybody seems to be missing?
Well, okay. So I think first, I'm not going to pretend to be a political expert. So, obviously, I also, kind of tracked the polls and really didn't see this coming. But what I do think is important here is to figure out the kind of market divergence that are resulting, because they are leading to a lot of volatility in the markets, and there are actually some trading opportunities that can basically result as people try and figure out. So, what I do know is that in the case of Brexit, there's obviously going to be a lot of uncertainty about how it actually takes place. I think we made the analogy before where the only previous example of a country leaving the European Union was actually Greenland in the 80s, leaving what was then the EEA. And even then, it took them, I think, 2 to 3 years, and all they had to worry about was basically fish. So, the UK situation is going to be just incredibly convoluted and uncertain. But the one thing we can look at, because, again, this is where leading indicators come into it, is that typically when you get a big plunging in exchange rates, as has happened here, it will mechanically lead to higher inflation. And what we've seen is that there were signs of inflation expectations becoming somewhat unhinged. And in turn, this will likely to pressure the BOE even though the initial market reaction at the time was actually pricing more cuts. So this would be like, you know, I would say a tangible example of how to use leading indicators to deal with the kind of uncertainty that's thrown out by shock events or these kind of uncertain things. Similarly with Trump, obviously, you know, I'm actually slightly bemused by the market reaction here, where obviously we're seeing super strong dollar, bond market sell-off, and equity markets rallying a lot. Now, to me, for all three to make sense, is you would basically need people to expect real growth to really pick up, as well as for inflation to pick up. I think our leading indicators have shown that there has been inflationary pressures in the system, but we've leaned more towards kind of the stagflation theme here. So it strikes me as strange in that because all leading indicators for the U.S. continue to show that the U.S. economy is still quite weak, and we've actually not found a very reliable lead from fiscal policy to growth, because there's typically a very uncertain lag time between when it's announced, actually when it's implemented. There's obviously a lot of uncertainty around the fiscal multiplier. So what we've actually found is that people tend to get a bit too excited about fiscal policy, and often it actually takes years before anything actually happens. And so in the intervening period, the key things to focus on are things like leading indicators. And right now in the U.S., you know, truck sales have declined quite a lot. You know, building permits are somewhat flattish. There's, you know, the fact that rent and medical CPIs have jumped a lot means that retail sales are likely to come under pressure. So there's actually some signs that the economy is actually not going to have this kind of massive growth acceleration. Now, there aren't signs that there's necessarily going to be a recession in the next 3 months, but that there isn't a sign of massive real growth. So that means this price action seems somewhat strange to me. I think typically this is kind of what people call the Soros trading, in a way, where when you have massive fiscal expansion and tight monetary policy, you should in theory get the currency to rally a lot. And indeed, I think the UK is the precise opposite, where UK was actually running austerity whilst they were running a pretty loose monetary policy. So that was, so you'd expect the pound to kind of sell off there. Now, what we're looking at here is the market has kind of already jumped ahead and said, okay, the Fed probably, obviously one hike, fair enough, you know, that's already priced. It's probably not going to hurt the market, but is the Fed really going to turn very, very hawkish when the leading indicator doesn't actually suggest the economy is doing well? There is some wage pressure, but, you know, Yellen states repeatedly she wants to run the economy hot.
High pressure economy.
Right. And then there's this really uncertain lag time with fiscal policy. So to me, if that's the backdrop and we don't think there's going to be massive, you know, 3-4% real growth, then you can't have a combination of stronger dollar and massively rallying equity markets and bond markets selling off a lot. So one of that is broken.
Yeah, this obviously there is definitely something that is very strange with regard to the fact that if we can provide a good amount of calculation that if in fact a currency comes down and this inflation will be higher and this good for their imports, good for their exports and maybe a little bit painful for their exports. We have, like you said, a very opposite and strange situation here in the U.S. You would have to think that with the dollar rally that we recently saw, that many of the companies that are globally involved, the major exporters, the ones that are that have the biggest global footprint, won't be doing well. And with respect to that, you know, some of them haven't done. We saw some of the large cap techs come down because of the offshore money and all of that. But what's really interesting is the incredible surge in the small caps here, almost to a point that you have to wonder, is anybody looking at valuation, or is it just simply that they're just betting on and banking on so far in advance, maybe a year or two out, that things will get better due to the potential for a fiscal stimulus plan that everybody's been yelling about, hoping for, and praying for a number of years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one thing I would say is I think these kind of more idiosyncratic events are somewhat hard to kind of predict in a robust and reliable way. I mean, if we go back to when Obama got elected and the Democrats had both houses, people would have said, okay, maybe he's going to pass Obamacare, therefore, we probably, you know, healthcare might do badly. Oh, he's going to pull out of Iraq, maybe defense stocks will do badly. And those two sectors actually ended up doing really well, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of an upside-down world to a degree. But you know.
This is why if you're going to be trading, investing in this environment, you have to go back to something that's robust and repeatable. And at least for us anyway, that means following things like leading indicators. And right now, the only sure thing with that is we think there is some kind of inflationary pressure still in the system. So you would think that trades more based on inflation going high does make sense, but not necessarily, but you know, we still probably lean towards more stagflation kind of environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tian Yang, thank you for joining us from Variant Perception. And we'll put the links, the information on how to get your various information on the disciplinedinvestor.com, the show notes of this show. And thanks for keeping me informed with all of your great writings. Appreciate it. Look forward to reading them in the future.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
All right. Have a great day.
Yes.
Well, due to my voice, and the inability for me to really speak very well, and that just comes with thinking very clearly, we're going to end it right there. And I want to thank you for joining me. Of course, if you have any questions, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Right on the show notes of this particular show, you can find information on Variant Perception, Tian Yang, as well as you can find a little area that you can actually ask questions. You can just simply go and ask questions to me, and I'll do my best to answer them on an upcoming episode or directly if it's a little bit more personal. And just don't forget that we're going to have this Investology offering, which is we call it advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced overall portfolio management strategy that is going to be something that you've never seen before. And that's coming out soon. It'll take a long time to develop this and to make it just as perfect as possible when it's launched. So we're thinking right in the beginning of 2017, we'll actually have some areas where you can express your interest. If you are interested, it's going to have much lower minimums. And also it will have the opportunity for you to get some really, really interesting reports, information, online access, and see what's going on in real time with your portfolios. Anyway, thanks for joining me again, and we'll see you next week with a much better voice and DH Unplugged on Tuesday night. I'll see you then.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.